I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This morning in the Rose Garden, President Obama introduced Merrick Garland, Chief Judge of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia, as his nominee to fill the embattled seat on the U.S. Supreme Court left vacant with the death of Justice Antonin Scalia. Garland is 63 years old, a graduate of Harvard Law School. Before becoming a judge, he was a prosecutor, supervised the Justice Department investigations into the 1995 Oklahoma City bombing and into Unabomber Ted Kaczynski. Republicans, of course, have vowed to block the nomination and say they will not hold hearings. We're looking at the new nominee and what he's up against, what the president is up against in pushing his nomination. This morning in the Rose Garden, President Obama announced the nominee.
Today I am nominating Chief Judge Merrick Brian Garland to join the Supreme Court.
A nominee, said the president, admired on all sides.
I've selected a nominee who is widely recognized not only as one of America's sharpest legal minds, but someone who brings to his work a spirit of decency, modesty, integrity, even-handedness, and excellence. These qualities and his long commitment to public service have earned him the respect and admiration of leaders from both sides of the aisle.
And there in the Rose Garden, Judge Merrick Garland himself, who will face who knows what as this nomination is pushed, talking about his view on life and the law.
Fidelity to the Constitution and the law has been the cornerstone of my professional life. And it's the hallmark of the kind of judge I have tried to be for the past 18 years. If the Senate sees fit to confirm me to the position for which I have been nominated today, I promise to continue on that course.
63-year-old Merrick Garland, now the nominee, in the Rose Garden at the White House this morning. And you can hear very clearly the emotion in his voice over this moment and maybe what may lie ahead with this nomination. To look at this man, moment, and the path ahead with us from San Francisco, Jeffrey Rosen, professor at George Washington Law School, contributing editor at The Atlantic, president, CEO of the National Constitution Center, big nonprofit, nonpartisan outfit devoted to explaining the U.S. Constitution and what it represents. His forthcoming book is Louis D. Brandeis, American Prophet. Jeffrey Rosen, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you with us today.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be back.
And with us from Washington, Randy Barnett, professor at Georgetown Law School, director of the Georgetown Center for the Constitution, senior fellow at the Cato Institute. He's got a new book coming out next month, Our Republican Constitution, Securing the Liberty and Sovereignty of We the People. Randy Barnett, thank you very much for being with us.
Nice to be back again, Tom.
Jeffrey Rosen, your first reaction to the president's choice of nominee, Merrick Garland.
What a remarkable ceremony it was. President Obama so clearly convinced that he had picked someone who was the embodiment of a bipartisan pick who in the past had been admired by Republicans and Democrats alike, so striking that he said when he asked Republicans which judge would be their ideal in the past, it would be Merrick Garland. And then, as you mentioned, the emotion in Merrick Garland's voice was so palpable, and also the profundity of his experience in law enforcement and the way it affected him. He talked about the Oklahoma City experience, where he was so scrupulous to demand subpoenas for evidence, even stuff that people were volunteering to turn over voluntarily. And he talked, both he and Obama really said, it's so important in these polarized times for the judges and courts to appear to be above partisan politics. It was just remarkable. But of course, there was such a poignancy to the situation because Judge Garland, so supremely well qualified for appointment, recognizing the battles that lie ahead, President Obama calling on the Senate at least to give him a fair hearing. It really was a high moment of constitutional drama.
Here was the president saying, look, I've talked to everybody to try and get a nominee who would be right, the president in the Rose Garden.
I've sought the advice of Republican and Democratic members of Congress. We've reached out to every member of the Senate Judiciary Committee, to constitutional scholars, to advocacy groups, to bar associations representing an array of interests and opinions from all across the spectrum.
Randy Barnett, we'll look at the way ahead and what it will or won't be, what it should or shouldn't be, but what about the man himself, the judge, the legal, constitutional thinker, Merrick Garland? How do you see him?
Well, this is probably the most personal Supreme Court nominee I've ever had to to watch since he and I were classmates at Harvard Law School together. Wow. He and I, not just classmates, we were in the same section of our first year class, and that means back in that day you took every single class with the same people, and so he really stood out as a classmate. We had 140 people in a section, and I didn't remember all of them, but no one forgot Merrick Garland. He was what law school students call a gunner in the class. He was the one that constantly spoke and but he didn't just speak to answer the questions. He actually spoke to challenge the professors, and so all of us admired him. And in some respects, we looked up to him as somebody who, you know, we might try to emulate as fellow law students.
Where would you place him in the spectrum of justices interpreting the Constitution today? Left, right, center, amalgam? What?
Well, look, I think there's two basic camps about the Constitution. One that believes in the limits that the federal government is placed under by the Constitution. It's what I call in my book the Republican Constitution. The other believes in more democratic majoritarian rule. And I think, although he's an extremely moderate, intelligent, and skillful jurist, he is on the other side of me from this. He would be somebody who would be supporting what would be considered to be the left side of the court as it's currently constituted. It would be, his appointment would represent a major change in the direction that the court currently has with the vacancy of Justice Scalia.
Jeffrey Rosen, give us your view on those stripes, how they sit on Merrick Garland.
I should say that, like Randy, I've known Merrick Garland for many years and admire him for the same reasons that Randy does, because of his intelligence and moderation and fair-mindedness. But as Randy suggests, the splits on the court are sort of cross-cutting. So there's no doubt that Merrick Garland would be much more sympathetic to federal power than both Randy and some of the more libertarian justices. He's quite deferential to the government, and in that sense, he's an acolyte of judicial restraint. He believes, as he said in his Rose Garden statement, the judges should interpret the law, not make it. That's a mantra that we've heard from Republican nominees for a long time. But he's also probably more sympathetic to law enforcement than some more libertarian judges on both the left and the right. His entire career was as a prosecutor. He talked about his experience prosecuting gangs as having shaped his life, like Justice Stephen Breyer, who sometimes votes with the conservative justices on criminal justice issues. You could well imagine Merrick Garland deferring to the government in criminal cases. So although Randy is ultimately correct that on the great social issues that are transfixing the country and the court, from marriage equality, affirmative action, voting rights, campaign finance, these are all cases where Merrick Garland, like any Democratic nominee, would tip the balance in replacing Justice Scalia. On the scale of Democratic nominees, this is one of the more moderate ones, which is why groups like the pro-choice groups have already said we need to hear more about his views on these matters. This is not a liberal ideologue by any chance. He actually is what President Obama presented him as, an open-minded, fair-minded, bipartisan, neutral judge.
But when you step back and look at the court, Antonin Scalia is the one who fate has taken off the bench at this point. We've seen decades of the Supreme Court moving in a more conservative direction. Would Merrick Garland be the major change in that? Would he reorient the court? Randy Barnett suggests he would, even with that moderation.
I think that he would, because although on criminal justice issues he may be deferential to the government, those are issues where liberal and conservative justices already have unusual alliances, and many of those cases are unanimous. There are no William Brennan-like judges on the court, the justice for whom Merrick Garland clerked, who are determined to, you know, sort of let out criminals on technicalities in a caricatured view. The court is deeply divided on the issues I mentioned and others, and these are ones where any Democratic nominee is likely to shift the balance, so that's why the seat is so consequential. I'm trying to think of any area in which Merrick Garland would deviate from shifting the balance. And I think on racial equality and voting rights, which he's been devoted to as both before and after he joined the D.C. Circuit, campaign finance, abortion, gay marriage, these are all cases where he would be on the opposite side of Justice Scalia and would indeed reorient the court.
Randy Barnett, let me get your view on that. We'll come to process again. The will he or won't he, should he or shouldn't he be confirmed or even heard But in terms of substance, what would you anticipate on the social or substantial front in let's say some decades perhaps of a Justice Merrick Garland and his impact?
Well, Jeff and I are in pretty total agreement about the likely impact that Judge Garland would have on the court. I just want to point out one other issue, which is gun rights and the Second Amendment. In the lower court in the D.C. Circuit invalidated the D.C. gun ban as unconstitutional under the Second Amendment. That is what was upheld. That lower court ruling is what was upheld in the Heller case. And Judge Garland was among the judges on the D.C. Circuit who voted to rehear that argument en banc. In other words, to reverse the lower court decision invalidating the law.
Help us through this, which puts him on the side then of gun control or against it with that ruling?
Well, not the policy question, but puts him on the side of the fact that the Second Amendment does not protect an individual right such that the D.C. gun ban violated it. He was on the other side of that. And then the D.C. Circuit voted not to hear that case again, and then it went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court affirmed the lower court. Justice Scalia's opinion affirmed the lower court. So that's a major difference that you can expect advocates who would oppose Judge
from
Garland.
From Scalia, the hunter, to Garland, the Heller impact here.
Right. But if I can take this opportunity to say, I do think I support the Republicans' refusal to consider any nominee, and the very fact that Judge Garland is such a highly qualified and moderate and reasonable nominee only underscores the principled nature of that opposition. That is, if he had been somebody who was more objectionable, then that would mean that the argument of principle that they should not be considering someone in an election year would be more partisan. But because he is so reasonable, it underscores the principled nature of the opposition to hearing any or considering any nominee, no matter how reasonable they are.
What is but that I, principle? I, the president's duly elected twice. The Constitution says, you know, nominate someone to the high court. He's done it. What's the principled objection?
Yes, the principle is that the president, a lame duck president, is going to be making an appointment that's going to be lasting decades and move the direction of the court in the ways that Jeff and I both agree it will be moved.
What difference does the point he's at in his tenure make in terms of his obligation to nominate?
Because we are in the middle of an election.
So what? He was elected in an election.
Well, so were the Republicans in Congress. In the Senate, they were elected as well.
Yeah, but they have their job and he has his, right? He's to nominate, they're to consider.
And their job is to refuse or to grant their consent as they wish for the reasons that they wish to refuse and grant their consent. They're under no obligation to do anything other than to consent or not consent. And as everybody knows, they consent all the time. They refuse to consent all the time by not taking up things, like not taking up House bills, not taking up treaties. That's how they operate. So they have every right to do. The president had every right to nominate. They have every right to refuse. And the principal reason is that this is now going to be the matter. The decision of what the direction of the future Supreme Court is going to be is now going to be a matter of a national election to be settled within months. And it's on the basis of that election that this nomination and that this seat should be filled.
But there was already a national election. In 2012, Barack Obama won it.
And in 2014, the Republicans took control of the Senate. There's now a new election coming up. We're talking about the future that extends well beyond Barack Obama's presidency. And the Republicans in the Senate are entitled to say that that decision should be made by the people in the next election.
Yeah, nearly all of course, Supreme Court additions to the bench go far beyond the president who supported them. Jeffrey Rosen, what about this issue of should or shouldn't the nominee be taken up and Randy Barnett's principle as described here?
Well, let me just talk about it historically and as neutrally as I can. In my riveting forthcoming book, Louis D. Brandeis, American Prophet,
riveting.
I tell a story. It's coming out on June 1st, which is the 100th anniversary of Brandeis's confirmation. Mm-hmm. And that's a significant date because Brandeis was nominated on January 28th, 1916, and confirmed 125 days later on June 1st. That was the longest that any nominee previously in American history has had to wait. And there is no precedent for anything longer than that. Now, it's true that that was a Democratic Senate and a Democratic president, and it's true that you have to go back to the 19th century to see long waits when presidents face a Republican Senate. But the bottom line is that although it's true that literally, the Senate can do what it likes, and the president has done what he views as his constitutional responsibility. President Obama says that if this precedent goes through, it will basically ensure a nuclear explosion of the increasing partisan nature of judicial hearings. And you really set up the possibility that, you know, to take the possibility that the Senate goes Democratic, imagine a Republican won, you could have a lame duck situation where the new Senate, the Democratic Senate, at the beginning of January, in the several weeks before inauguration of the new president, decides to confirm Merrick Garland or any other nominee, and the precedent for that is the midnight judges of the election of 1800, where John Adams literally stays up all night signing judicial commissions in order to pack the bench to deny the seats to Thomas Jefferson. So just as the Constitution doesn't require hearings, but I think we can just say descriptively that there is no precedent for the Senate completely refusing to act before in American history. And if it does this, then all bets are off for the future.
Randy Barnett, you describe President Obama as a lame duck president. How far back would that go then, that description for you? All the way back to 2014? Would it be 2 years of a term that would, if midterms went to the other party, that you would describe as unsuitable for a new nominee?
Well, Tom, as I'm sure you know, Senator Biden, when he was chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, gave a lengthy floor speech in which he outlined the principle that Democrats would follow if President Bush had nominated someone, if a vacancy had occurred in the final year of his term and Bush had nominated somebody. He said that Democrats would not take that nomination up. So this is a position that Democrats have held in the past, and there's no question that if the situation were reversed, they would do the exact same thing for the exact same reason.
Well, that is what politicians like to call a hypothetical, but you may be right. The reality of what unfolds here, we will see soon enough, and we're very grateful to the two of you for beginning to introduce us to Merrick Garland, President Obama's nominee for the seat vacated with the death of Antonin Scalia. Randy Barnett at Georgetown Law School, author of the forthcoming Our Republican Constitution. Thank you for joining us, sir.
Thanks, Tom.
And Jeffrey Rosen, look for his Louis D. Brandeis American Prophet. Jeffrey Rosen, thank you for being here today.
Thank you. A pleasure.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.